Hey, you're listening to Sloancast, the one-stop shop deep dive where we discuss anything and everything about the greatest band of all time. Jay Ferguson, Chris Murphy, Patrick Pellin, and Andrew Scott, collectively known as Sloan. We are your fellow superfan hosts. I'm Rob. This is Ken. Ken, have you ever stayed up one time until late in the evening?
I am currently staying up one time until very late in the evening. I'm having so much fun, and I did and thought even then that I would not ever get to part 43 of a podcast about the greatest band of all time, but here we are. I only said briefly in jest last time that our discussions on Action Pact would be a 17-parter, and the further and further I get into this topic, the more I feel as though that could be a reality. We're uncovering a lot of more interesting little rocks as we pull apart the big rocks. And speaking of big rocks, we are honored today to have a very special
say hot
guest.
Rocks. Okay, go ahead.
I'm not the king of the segue as you are, Rob, but we're honored to have a special guest on the podcast today to continue our discussion on an album that's turning 20 this year. Chris, welcome to Sloancast.
Yeah.
Hey guys, thank you so much for having me. And listen, I was listening to you guys say the greatest band of all time, and it's all I can do to interrupt and say, listen, guys, you can't be saying that with me here. I sound like a goofball, but no, keep it up. Not that I disagree, but you know, I can't be saying that. I have to interject and say, please, come on, guys, stop being so hyperbolic. But anyway,
I made you.
Yeah, we're
sure
one of the greats.
Destroy now. But anyway, yeah, man, thank you so much for being here. And you know what? This is the first time that we've had somebody on the show who's on the road. Like, you're actually out there as of recording right now. You're on the second leg, I guess, the West Coast steady tour. You're a few dates in. How's it been going?
It's pretty good. Like, we are enjoying basically the best crowds that we've had in the 2000s, probably. And I don't know what to attribute that to or to what to attribute that. I don't know if it's just that the pandemic is long enough over that people are actually going to come out now, or if it's that, you know, is it because like in Canada, like, you know, Rush is gone and the Tragically Hip is gone. And it's like, well, who else is, it's kind of like a last man standing kind of thing. I mean, Blue Rodeo's kind of like clearly the Kings, I guess, or the Arkells or something like that. But anyway, but whatever the case, and I don't mean to, be celebrating, you know, both of those examples like ended in, you know, the tragic death of some of the guys. But anyway, whatever the case, people are coming to see us. People are saying nice things about Record Steady. And as a bonus, everybody in the band is really getting along, probably better than we have in a long time too. So like, it's awesome on the road.
It's excellent to hear.
It's great.
And yeah, so great. Thank you again for joining us today. And I'm not sure if you've had a chance to hear it lately.
I want to set the record straight. Set the record straight on Action Pact.
Yes, please.
You know, the much, much maligned.
Yeah, we've been wanting to review the album. And then also, I mean, the bonus of having you here to talk to us about it. So many questions, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like because maybe this record was something that was done sort of out of house, maybe there's a little more mystery about it. It seems like maybe, you know, the jobs and the various aspects of the record were sort of like farmed out, you know, produced by somebody else and the artwork done by this guy and that guy. And, you know, so, whereas with the other records, you guys are so hands-on and there's so much out there about what was done and the history and so on. So yeah, thank you again for joining us. But what would be an appropriate jumping off place? I mean, in the previous episode, we kind of caught the listener up to what, you know, what you guys were doing sort of post Pretty Together 2001. You're pretty much playing live all of 2001 rather, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
All of 2002, it appears as though you're playing for the most part. Is that correct? You guys are just on the road a ton.
Yeah. I mean, we're still going for it. You know what I mean? Like, we're still, even though I did hear your other episode, and of course I'm a long time listener. I listen to all this stuff and I feel like you do this just for me, but whatever. I'm happy that other people listen too, but no, I listen every time. I can't remember all of the details of what you said. And I know you guys are as expert as anyone. I'm basically, the only thing I'm an expert in is myself, which is psychotic, but that's what I am. But, so yeah, so, and you can interrupt me and say, I already kind of told people that, but in Canada, Pretty Together, we had been kind of like through the Universal system or the MCA Universal system for the first five records. And then we changed, like we had a definitely a commercial drop with Between the Bridges. It came way down in 1999. I think you probably have covered this, but like we did a record in 98, then a live record and another studio record, and all within about 18 months. And we didn't do much promo for our Four Nights at the Palais Royal record. We just kind of threw it out there, and it was a giant package and it was expensive. And stores were trying to return that as we were trying to put Between the Bridges in stores. So it was like basically the commercial beginning of the end. But so that was kind of the end of our tenure with Universal. I think that they thought that we were kind of done, and we got picked up by BMG in Canada for Pretty Together. And that kind of pulled us out of the garbage, because we had two singles, what's it called? If It Feels Good, Do It. And The Other Man, they both got on radio. They got on Much Music. And so, you know, we were like selling 80,000 records in Canada, 70,000 Navy Blues, 26,000 Between the Bridges. And then we're back up to 40,000 again. And this is as streaming, or not streaming, but like Napster and that stuff is kind of kicking in and all that kind of stuff. So we're still, you know, we had a bit of an upswing after Between the Bridges. So we're happy about it. And then I think, you know, I tipped you off to some of this stuff, and you said last time, but that our record, Pretty Together, got picked up and distributed by RCA in the States. BMG in Canada got really excited about that and decided to pour all kinds of money into it. So we get sent to work with Tom Rothrock. We were trying to, I think you said before, but we were trying to saddle up to this guy, Steve Rubelsky, or whatever his name is. The guy who's the A&R guy of the Strokes, basically like, who do you think we should use to, and the Strokes are on RCA. I was like, who do you think we should use as a producer? And he suggested Tom Rothrock. And we were like, yeah, that's a good idea. Good idea. You know, we're a team, right? Yeah. Good idea, Steve. And so we go and we decided to make a record with Tom Rothrock, his pedigree being he worked with Beck and he worked with Elliott Smith. He made a bunch of records with that guy. What's his name? Do you know this? Tom Rothrock. And I'll think of it in a second. He had a partner character, and the two of them made a bunch of records. I should know what that is. I'm sorry. I'll look it up quickly. But we decided to make a record with Tom Rothrock in LA, spend tons of dough. We used BMG's money, and I personally wasn't that comfortable doing it, but we were like in our mid 30s. And we were like, we can always go back to making our own records. Mm. If this is a failure, we might as well one more kind of kick at the can. Mm. And Tom Rothrock was kind of producing. We had only really ever worked with a producer one other time, which was Jim Rondinelli on Twice Removed. Mm. And, you know, I still kind of think that even that was mostly self-produced. Jim Rondinelli he used all this beautiful gear, and Twice Removed sounds beautiful. But Tom Rothrock wanted to make a streamlined rock record with harmonies. And we made the sort of like Def Leppard joke is like, oh, AC/DC with harmonies. Oh, Def Leppard. And nothing wrong with that. So that was the big idea. And the other thing that was interesting about it is because someone else was going to help us with song selection, we wrote more songs. We wrote more than just like, well, I finished the 12th song, let's go record. Mm-hmm. So we recorded way more. So we had all kinds of songs. Some of them came out later. You know, All of the Voices is from then, and okay. Carried Away was from then. But Tom Rothrock wanted to make a sort of kind of rock record. And even those, the Rest of My Life is kind of like it's like a minor seventh chord in it and stuff like, you know, some non-rock and stuff in it. We still kind of did it kind of rock. And so we go to LA. So we did a whole demo. We basically made the record before Tom Rothrock showed up, and then we re-recorded it with him in LA. You know, we probably made it a bit sweeter than it would have been if we had just done what we did in our studio. But
so this is where I want to jump in quick and ask. I mean, just talking difference between recording Pretty Together, like in the last episode we talked about, obviously that took a great deal amount of time. You guys really took your time. I imagine everybody, you know, everybody's at home. Everybody's got their own computer. They're able to record their own pieces, put it together, you know. A song like Your Dreams.
That's right. And just, sorry. And you may have said this before, but like Pretty Together was our first record that we made on computer. Mm-hmm. Between the Bridges was tape with kind of ADAT augmentation. But yeah, so Pretty Together was recorded on computer, 2001, early digital, and probably sounds definitely, I think that people thought it was slick, a bit slick for Sloan. I think some of that is in the production. And I think some of that is just because it was digital and probably really tidied up in a way, perhaps, that the others hadn't been. And I really, yeah, I thought it, anyway, it was fine. Like Pretty Together, I know that Ken champions it. I appreciate it, Ken. And again, much maligned, sometimes maligned Pretty Together. But Action Packed is computer as well, but just like not high concept, like just like really kind of meat and potatoes, like digital meat and potatoes. Like it's weird, but I like it. You know, I'm proud of it. The thing that bothered me most about it was the fact that it was our most recent statement for seemingly so long. It seemed like, I guess it was 3 years or more. Yeah. And I was dying. I was just like, oh my God, like, why can't we do another record? Like nothing against Action Pack, but you know, some people didn't like it. Andrew didn't have a song. And then it just took so long. That was just who we were for so long. And I was really uncomfortable about it.
I mean, we talked briefly in the last episode about how different those three statements are. You go from Pretty Together to Action Packed to Never Hear the End of It. And it's hard to believe it's the same band. I'm wondering, you know, you've spoken before about wanting to not make the same record twice and wanting to have each record kind of stand for itself. Was the song selection and sort of what you were preparing for Action Packed a premeditated effort to put out something that was different, or was it really, did it come from the production, sort of that separation from what came before and what became after?
The only thing that I thought that we were kind of playing with, first of all, as soon as anyone, and it's usually me, says, hey, why don't we do this? Like, I'm dealing with three resounding no's, like whatever my idea is like, they're like, whatever your idea is, we want to do the opposite of that. So I try not to, whatever. If I do have an idea, I basically have to sneak it in. But the only thing that I think that's a lot of the songs have going on is we tried to make songs that were basically one chord progression. And like, if you can think of the other Man, which came out, which was on Pretty Together, it's essentially, there's a middle part and there's a kind of like, it rolls into threes at the end, but the verse structure and the chorus structure are the same chordally. You know what I mean, right?
Right.
Ken?
Yes, of course.
Well, so Live On, so I'm talking about Action Pack now. So Live On, False Alarm, Nothing Lasts Forever Anymore, Ready For You, Reach Out, and Fade Away are essentially one progression chord songs. And I also, on this record, essentially said no bass lines.
Right.
Like it's all just like dum-dum,
right,
you know,
root.
I mean, jokes about the bass player, like right, anybody can, you know, the non-musician guy.
Hey, sometimes you do go up an octave. So there's that.
That's true. Yeah.
There's some flourishes for sure.
Creates some excitement. No, but basically the biggest problem with that was probably like I had tons of time to just jackass around on stage and room to have my hand up half the time. Anyway, right. But I just mean like, I was kind of like, I was at the time, I was kind of into like the non-rock new music, like whether it was Destiny's Child or, you know, as early as 1998, that The Boy Is Mine, like that Brandy and Monica song. Like I was just really into the musical economy of those are like one chord progression songs.
Sure.
And I just thought that's kind of fun to try to play because, you know, as you say, like, Pretty Together is really all over the place in a good way, or in a way that I'm not embarrassed of. Like, I think it's, you know, we've been accused, I said before, of having compilation style records, something that never phases me. Actually, I meant to ask you earlier, because I did hear you say Pretty Together to Action Packed to Never Hear the End of It is kind of like kind of weird left turns all the time. But maybe this is a boring question, but like if you took Action Packed out of it, does it make more sense to go from Pretty Together to Never Hear the End of It? They're both kind of like eclectic, or is it mostly just having Action Packed in the middle is the curveball?
Yeah, I think for me personally, right? And even at that time, I think that, you know, fans were very aware of this being sort of a a concerted effort to put something out that is different and that is kind of very straightforward and in some ways is not ambiguous, right? I think it's very much what it is, and Action Pact never tried to be anything else. So I feel as though it's so hard for me to decouple these three records from each other because they only exist because of each other. That's sort of the theory that we were putting out there in the Never Hear the End of It episode. They're each a reaction to their predecessor.
Well, that's true for sure. Like we kind of thought that, yeah, Pretty Together is a little bit all over the place. Let's just like streamline it. And then I was so frustrated by how like a streamlined, the flip side of something that's streamlined is something that's like unidimensional. And I didn't want to be that. And I just, and then as you say, like Never Hear the End of It is kind of like an explosion of eclecticism. And that's the one that I feel more proud of, or feel like is more, no one else can do this or whatever. And, Action Pact is like, you know, Def Leppard could have done it, I guess, or whatever.
I've never heard a Def Leppard record all the way through. I was going to say, it's almost like Revolver, Sgt. Pepper's Into White Album or something. You know what I mean? Like very different sounding, but you know, the pieces are all there and they make sense in order, you know, like something with this, that's, you know, great songwriting and sort of feels like one piece into something that's more of like Sgt. Pepper's. To me, the whole thing just sounds like the same album in the same vein as Action Pact. And, you know, the White Album is this big double album gift, and not to go back to the Beatles comparison again, but it just in you know, to compare to something. That's
what I was going
to
say. I'm unfamiliar with your references. I don't understand what you're saying. Again, like I love all those Beatles references and I'm constantly making them, but I can't control everybody else's thing. I never say let's do a Beatles statement, because then Patrick be like, let's make a Killing Joke record. I'm just like, I don't know who that is.
I think it's a Batman.
But,
just kidding.
But what was I going to say? I don't know. Whose turn is it? Am I answering or asking a question?
Well, we're coming out of Pretty Together, which was very drawn out process. You guys are recording at home. Now you can kind of, and obviously I have to assume from your perspective, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, like the Pretty Together record coming out and that tour and stuff must have felt like a giant wave, you know, like, new distribution support. And as far as I was concerned as fans, like you guys were everywhere. You know, the videos were huge and the shows seemed really big. And so to know then that you're, and I mean, obviously I didn't know this at the time, but to hear that you guys are going to LA and you guys are going to do the big rock record there, you know, with a slick producer and stuff, that's kind of not really a surprise. It almost feels like the next logical step.
We were happy to get the opportunity. We kind of thought after Between the Bridges that we were, maybe we were done or whatever. We kind of felt like, like we were given another chance with Pretty Together. And but we were guys in our 30s. Like the Strokes were younger than us, but like the Strokes were cool. And it's like, maybe if the Strokes have kind of kicked down a door, maybe there's a lane for us or something. Because there weren't other, I don't know what our other reference points would have been at the time, or maybe the White Stripes or something, even though I don't know how big a radio band they were, but like they were beloved and playing to a lot of people and selling lots of records and all that kind of stuff. Mm. But
you could almost say
I kind of feel like Action Pack was a bit heavy for, like we played some shows with the Strokes and I kind of thought that it was a bit too old school rock for those guys who were a little bit more jangly or whatever, like, and we were a little bit too Gibsons and not, you know, Fenders. I don't know. Does that make any sense? Do you know the joke about somebody at one point saying that he's like comparing us to, or just saying that we've gone too far and like we're like, I like your rock music, but I don't like the rock music that where you sound like you're on a Harley or whatever. Like it just goes a little too far, too far into rock world, like Harley rock. Sorry, the other thing I was going to say, maybe this is too derailing of a thing, but like when you as people who were following along at the time, like I know, Ken, that you're a Pretty Together apologist, but do you feel like among Sloan fans that it was seen as, you know, with the other man being commercial or, you know, sounding more like U2 than Sloan, like did you feel like there was kind of like sort of hated at the time, even though I know I've heard you guys speak about and I agree that it sort of makes more sense now, like seeing what we went on to do. But like maybe at the time it was just like, what's this junk? Like, I think I would also just add that I think that we did an about face between record one and two. Then like the indie rockers loved Twice Removed, and you know, partly because of its kind of failure story, but also it was like very kind of playing by the rules of indie rock. But then One Chord to Another added a little bit, it got a bit more rocking. And I think the indie rockers always say that they love Twice Removed, even though I think that One Chord to Another is better. And then we got even more rock with Money City. Mm. And I think a lot of the really kind of like indie rockers, like specifically you thought like, this is a joke. And then by the time we have like Feels Good Do It. And then The Other Man is like, really? Like this kind of like secretary music or whatever?
Temporary secretary. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, I think you touch on a good point there, is that by Pretty Together, I feel as though the first generation of Sloan fans, the Smeared and Twice Removed fans, will have either stuck with you or left. Like that's, I think that,
and how many generations do you guys claim there are? Do you say that there are three, or do you say that there are more than that?
Well, we claim that there are three. I feel as though there are potentially more now that we see, you know, 12-year-olds coming out of the woodwork and being experts.
I don't count them yet. They're indoctrinated.
Right. They have to prove themselves. If we think about, you know, first generation fans pre-breakup, second generation fans, everything until never hear the end of it, essentially. I feel as though what I was seeing back then was a lot of really crusty people who had been with you from the start,
right,
expecting you would put out another Twice Removed.
Yeah.
And if Pretty Together wasn't sort of the nail in the coffin for the On the Fence fans, then Action Packed, I feel, would have doubled down.
Me too. Yeah.
I think for many, it was kind of clear at what you guys were trying to do by Action Packed. I think that was by that point, you know, clear that, you know, Between the Bridges and Navy Blues are kind of similar, but they aren't. Pretty Together is different. Action Packed is different. And the next one will be different too. It's not that the band is trying to make the exact same musical statement every time, which is, you know, made the wait between Action Packed and Never Heard the End of It feel all the longer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was excruciating for me. Because I did feel, I almost got in a fist fight with a guy at Pop Montreal who was like right up in my face, you know, Action Packed. I don't know if it had just come out. It may have even been like 2 years old or something, but he got right up on my face. Like, what happened to you guys, man? You guys used to be cool. And I almost got in a fist fight. I'm glad I didn't get in a fist fight, but I almost beat the guy up. I probably would have got beat up, but I almost, you know, I was in a rage, but I was probably mad at myself too. I was like, yeah, what did happen to us? We were cool. But I, you know, still fantasized that we were still cool. But again, that's
a different... That guy doesn't own any of your records, by the way.
Well, it's different when, you know, when you're just into your 30s and it's just like, maybe that's the end of the run. And now I'm in my 50s and it's different. It's like, I know that we're not cool. And I'm just sort of like defiantly putting out a 13th record. It's like, it's different. I was more desperate to hold on to what we had and what we were clearly losing by then to like whoever it was in Canada, certainly Arcade Fire, but even like, you know, Matthew Good and whatever, Sam Roberts or whoever. But, you know, I was probably more, it was probably as desperate as I have ever been, I guess, at the time. I was like, what are we going to do? Keep what we have. And, you know, we're still here. And so we have kept what we have, which is like a great repertoire and the same guys and all that kind of stuff. You know, obviously we're not on the tips of everyone's tongues, but, you know, we've got a couple of podcasts about us.
There's a few out there. But I was going to say, to kind of comment on what you guys were both talking about a second ago with Other Men and stuff, people's reaction to it. Like for me, just from my perspective, I always felt like, you know, a lot of times when a band has a certain sound and then they kind of have a song that is maybe more seemingly appealing to radio or appealing to, you know, the mass audience. When I first heard Other Men, before it was a single, I was like, oh, that's a single. Like that was my impression of it. Like that's gotta be the next one. And it was a song that was so big at radio and so appealing to everybody, but also great. Whereas so many of those songs that are like the big, you know, they're throwing their worm out into the lake and trying to get a bunch of fish. They're fishing is what I'm trying to say. that song usually sucks for most bands. You know, that big, the song.
Right. The Flame by Cheap Trick. I have a joke that this is The Flame.
but you kind of did it twice in a row in a way, Pretty Together, Other Man. And then the next single that we have is Rest of My Life. And you have these two great mid-tempo, like just bangers that have that ability in both cases to reach a huge mass audience. And still in the set list today, like the millions of times I've seen you guys, you know, hardcores want to hear this and that, but I mean, those are two song examples right there that are just going to bring the house down every time. So,
just sidebar, like for me, the songs that I feel like I've contributed to the greatest hits or whatever, you know, Underwhelmed, Coax Me, The Other Man, and The Rest of My Life. And, you know, arguably She Says What She Means, it was a single, but like it didn't do anything. Yeah, so it's kind of a polarizing song. And did I tell you the story, or did you relay the story that I went to BMG with The Other Man and said, do you guys think this is commercial? Because if not, I don't even want to do it. Like, I kind of think it's arguably maybe dorky. Like, I don't know this is kind of outside of our oeuvre or whatever. And
but so prior to recording, this was the conversation.
I had a demo maybe, and I played it for Keith Porteous at Vic, I guess it's called, like BMG Canada or whatever. Like they had their domestic A&R was called Vic, V-I-K or whatever, some disgusting name. But he was into it. He was like, no, I think this is a hit. So we continued along. And then he, and just sidebar, he went on to like did this whole radio edit of it. So it starts with like all this acoustic guitar and stuff. It's like, whatever, dude, go for it. We thought it was goofy. But anyway, I'm proud of The Other Man. It still gets a big roar from all the housewives and little girls. But no, I think it's a good one.
That's the name of the next album, please. Album 14, please. That's going to be the title.
So maybe I'm setting the scene too much. Should we talk about the record itself, or what would be helpful for me to get into?
100%. I have a lingering question in the back of my head, because we've been talking about how On the Sleeve Action Packed is, and that it's, you know, made for the stage. It's essentially a bunch of songs that are really easy to perform and that they still, you know, kind of make a statement and do well live. Yeah. Which of the tracks do you feel, if any, would fit well in sort of a more contemporary Sloan package? Like, which of the tracks do you feel is probably least in place in the sort of replicable four chord pattern that you were talking about earlier?
Right. To me, Jay's songs are not like, they're not boneheaded at all. Like they're like, you know, they're just like, it's just what he does. And in the song selection process, Andrew had Helen on, you know, in the pot or whatever, but you know, I had like 10 songs. Patrick had 10 songs. Jay had quite a few songs too. And I felt like Rothrock was kind of leaning towards Patrick and me more. And we wanted to make sure that Jay was represented, and Andrew didn't care. So we didn't use Helen in the end. I guess I don't feel like any of them are like, boy, we would sure never do a song like this on any other record. But, you know, The Rest of My Life, I think of that as a singer-songwriter song that's just played loudly. Like, I think that's whatever. It's got craft. All of them have a little bit of craft. Like, Give Me That is boneheaded stuff, but I love it. Like, to me, I thought it was going to be a hit. I was like, this is perfect. It's Patrick and me back and forth. Do you know we think of that as being kind of like a Sheryl Crow back and forth on that one? Have we talked about that before? Like that, you know, I can't decide. We think of that as kind of like a Sheryl Crow kind of thing. There's a specific song. I can't remember what it is.
The Soak Up the Sun, right? That sounds very, the melody is very, that was her, I don't know.
Like her first big
pre-Lance song? Pre-Lance Armstrong hit.
Maybe. Backstabbing. I forgot about Backstabbing is the most kind of specifically
where the Harley's revving up bone in the intro, right?
but no different than Pick It Up and Dial It from the record before is also kind of I guess I want to think that we try to make records different than each other, but kind of in my mind, like anything is modular.
Okay. Interchangeable. All right.
But clearly like Ready For You is just like very simplistic. And I think Hollowhead, I don't know, it's pretty simplistic too, but Nothing Lasts Forever Anymore is kind of one chord progression the whole time until the end. And it's very minor chords. Like, again, that song, I don't know if you want to go through the songs with any kind of in order, whatever the word I want, systematically or whatever, or if I should just like randomly just barf out information. Barf, my favorite verb.
That'll be the 15th album title. We could go through the songs and just if you have like impressions of them, like a memory of something or some sort of idea about the, you know, impetus for it. I was going to actually ask you because the last time I saw you guys, you were doing "I Was Wrong" in the set, and I'm not sure if it's remained.
We went back to "I Was Wrong" when we played out east just now. We played a bunch of songs from Navy Blues because we didn't do the Navy Blues shows out there, and now we've kind of reinstated some of the songs that we played in November.
Stand by Me.
"I Was Wrong." "I Was Wrong" is back in the set, and Follow the Leader is back in the set.
I don't know if this is too inside a question, but with the 20th anniversary, any thought? I mean, could a song like Nothing Lasts Forever Anymore find its way back into the set? Like the uniqueness of it? I mean, certainly, you know, a palate cleanser in the set for sure, in between other maybe more traditional rock and songs.
I like that song, but no, I don't hear anyone yelling for it. The thing is, like, in any given set, you know, I play, so on this tour, this Steady Tour, I play 4 new songs. I play The Other Man, The Rest of My Life, and Underwhelmed. So those are my kind of like, I should be playing at least some of these things. I play, and so my wild cards are, what did I say? Follow the Leader. Mm-hmm. I think that's all I get to do. Like, I don't have any more wild cards. Like, mm-hmm. I play, that's it. So, mm-hmm. so on a new album tour where we're force feeding so much new material, like there's not a lot of room for deep cuts. So we have to, we're playing 12 new songs. Like it's insane, but we do it defiantly. But for that, like, I feel like I should throw in some songs for spouses, as I say, you know, your other man's. And then I get one wild card. And, you know, I also like to play Fading Into Obscurity, but we've done that a lot. So, you know, I want to show off something, ambitious, so we're doing Follow the Leader. So nice. I'd love to do all of these songs, but you know, but we don't have time.
Understood.
Well, and as much as I love the songs on the record that we're currently inflicting on people, like a lot of those songs are probably going to go in the garbage by next fall, you know what I mean, and we'll never play them again. Or we'll play them 20 years from now, aka we'll be dead. But definitely has nothing to do with the fact that I don't think the song is great. It's just like it's the nature of having moved on.
Cool. Well, hey, man, we could talk through the tracks for sure. But I was kind of curious about just kind of getting back to the day-to-day of the recording. You said that you demoed all the songs prior to going to LA or whatever, and you're there with Rothrock and stuff. Was he sort of, how hands-on was he? Was he even there? Was he like a Rick Rubin type, somebody who kind of just checks in? Or was he more just like, hey, check out this pedal, or you can put that through this delay? Or, you know, was he saying?
He was always around. So he came, we recorded a bunch of demos ourselves in November, December of 2002. Then he came to town. He may have come to town in December 2002, but he definitely came in January 2003. And we ran the songs with him. We were playing songs to click. And he would sometimes he would just give us a click. He was aware of the fact that we were kind of a dysfunctional. And so he would have us play together. You know that we didn't do a lot of playing together and playing on each other's songs. We hadn't really done in a couple of years, even by then in 2002 and 3. So it was novel to be playing all together in configuration 1 or A or whatever. And he would start us out. He would start by just like putting like a click track on. And we were like, he was like, just jam to this. And we're like, nothing good comes of that. What are we going to do? Like blues and A every time? Like we suck at that. And so we did record a couple of blues and A jams. And we actually did put together a song that in my mind sounded incredibly generic, or like something closer to Def Leppard. And nothing, I think the Def Leppard songs are done with care and craft. And the, ours was, it was just like part A, part B, part C, part D. Like if you think of a song like Photograph by Def Leppard, there's like four different choruses in that song. It's insane. It's like, it's so produced and catchy and ambitious and simple, yet simple. So we ended up with a song like that, I think that Tom Rothrock also wanted to sort of kind of co-write. Like, I think he wanted to sort of like, yeah, we jammed this together and here's a lyrical idea and like throw his name in there, whatever. Like, not in a way that I find underhanded. I just think that's like, we don't have a lot of experience dealing with producers. And I just think that's kind of like the world they live in, you know, they do that kind of thing. He was trying to encourage us to write songs together. And we just thought it was, the results were generic. So there were a couple of things like that we did. And even that song called Wish Upon a Satellite that ended up on our 2018 record 12. Right. That was, we kind of had a version of that at the time too. We just like shine a light on me. It was just so boring to me. Like the shine a light on me. It just sounded like totally without content. Like it's just like Patrick was quite into it. And he's like, let's make this into a hit. And then I ruined it by making it a convoluted idea about like whatever. But years later. But so anyway, so Rothrock's got us jamming together. Oh, do you know the story about him making us go to the movies together?
I said, do tell.
But anyway,
our listeners don't.
Tom Rothrock, producer from LA, was in Toronto, and we were showing up kind of daily to practice. We got there one day. All right, let's get into it. He's like, you know what? I'm going to take you guys to see Standing in the Shadows of Motown. We're going to the movies, boys. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, we've never been to the movies together. We went once in Scotland to see Reservoir Dogs. It was the last movie we saw together.
Wow.
And so we all went, Patrick was furious. He's like, this is, what is this for? Like, this is so stupid. Anyway, we went,
was Andrew,
I don't know what he learned.
Like,
basically, we're supposed to go see Cocaine Bear tonight together, but I'm just seeing it's like, Harris just said everybody bailed. But anyway, he took us to see that movie. We were all just kind of pinching each other laughing. It's like, this guy does not understand that we basically don't do anything together. But we went, and I guess we learned a valuable lesson that, you know, there are good musicians in the world, or I don't know what we were doing there. But anyway, that was just kind of funny and just like this weird sidebar. It's like, is this what producers do? It just seemed really kind of Rick Rubin vibe guy stuff to do. And then when we finally went to Los Angeles, he booked like a week in a studio to record all the drums. And then we were going to do the rest of the overdubs in his house. And the studio that we went to in LA was called Conway. And I think we did all the beds in like 2 days. And even that, I think we probably could have just done them all in like 5 hours. Andrew's so good. And, you know, we could have patched up any mistakes we made. I'm not playing any bass lines, so I can lay it down too. And a lot of it is just like, a lot of it was fairly easy to play. And then we, you know, overdubbed some solos and stuff. I think in the end, we were just like killing time there. It's like, well, what else should we do? We've done everything. But I don't even remember how long we were there, but it didn't take us long to do the bed tracks because the songs were simple. The instrumentation was easy too. And so we just blew through it. Then we went to his house and ate meatball salads.
I just want to interject how charmed I am by the idea that this guy, who's like a super producer at this time, doesn't understand the sort of beautiful deconstruction of what makes you guys so great. You know, like it's funny that he's trying to apply these traditional layers of like, well, we're going to have this togetherness and this oneness and, you know, something that probably works for 99% of whatever project he's working on. But, you know,
We were kind of into it. Like we weren't that romantic together by that time. You know, we had been a band, whatever it is, 12 years or something at that point. He was probably also, you know, he's recorded Elliot Smith or Beck. Like I think he was maybe more used to like a single-minded, or like we're more hive-minded and And we're not, you know, you guys know the nature of our democracy is not really we all decide on an idea or we all decide we're going to gang up on this idea. Like everyone just gets their own space. We're an experiment in sharing space or whatever. And whatever, he was cool about it. He was not, it's not like he was insensitive. If anything, he was like an overly sensitive guy. And we were like more like cynical dudes. He's kind of a hippie. So like we would be doing vocal tracks and he'd just be lying on his back beside me. And he's like, sing that 8 times, man. I'm like, ugh, great idea. Whatever. Like, I'd be like, I could have thought of that, but whatever. Like he's a lovely guy.
You're reminding me of the Rick the Temp interview where he asks you guys about doing vocal lessons. Was that something that Rothrock was sort of pushing on you guys or?
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So he had a neighbor who gave vocal lessons. I forget. He had like a roster of people he had dealt with. I don't know who, Mick Jagger, or like, you know, impressive people or whatever. And, Andrew wasn't around to go. Patrick was furious that he had to go. And I think shirked out on that. Maybe went to one and then just was just like, I'm not going to that.
Imagine Jay if tried to did dance less.
So he would be this guy though. He said that I could benefit. He's like, you're going to benefit from vocal lessons. He said to me, we didn't go together. We went separately. So I don't know their experience. I just know that Patrick was like, this guy, I'm not doing this. And I'm a pleaser and I'm just like, I'll do, you know, Tom wanted me to go. I'll do what I can. Like I'm not paying, not costing me anything. And it'd be interesting to see, but you know, I'm saying to the guy, like, I literally have to sing this. You gotta give me that, give me that. And you want me to sing, you got to give me that, give me that. And he's like, that's excellent. I'm like, I'm not doing that. Like, come on, man. That's not cool. And in my mind, I'm like, I got a cool rock voice, but I'm probably going to destroy it, you know, by the time I'm 50 or whatever. But, and I just did 4 shows in a row and it does destroy my voice. But, ultimately, you know, I think in order for, it was goofy because like, you know, he wants, you know, anyway, I think that there is value in taking vocal lessons that help you keep from destroying your voice, but I didn't need to find a new voice that was, you know what, I like my voice and all that stuff, but anyway, I did think that the guy was a little bit out of touch with what we were all about, but whatever, it was fun for weirdness value.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Do we want to, speaking of give me that, do we want to blaze through some of these songs? I would love to.
I think give me that's awesome. You know, it's 4 semitones too high. It's insanely high, but you know, I think it was, it's just another rock box in the Money City line of rock boxes. You know what I'm talking about, Ken? Do you need to explain? Do you need to unpack what a rock box is for the listener?
So essentially going in a box form around the fretboard. Moving from,
we do that lots of times. The thing is, it's in C sharp. I guess I thought that, well, it can't be in B because it's the exact same as Good and Everyone and Money City. So like, I guess I'll go even higher. And it was just, I could do it in the studio, but when I have to do it more than twice in a row, it's killer. So it's only ever do it now, one-off shows, like in the summer or something, because it kills me. And maybe if I had learned how to sing it, give me that, I could sing it every night. What's it about? I kind of think of it as being, yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I loved, you know, in our Gregory interview from last year, he talked about meeting you guys and hanging out. And I think he talked about being in a hotel room and maybe Jay leaned over to the radio and just subtly turned up the volume. And I don't know if maybe you guys had a copy of the album at the time. It wasn't out yet. And he's like, this is the first song off our new record or whatever. And Gregory's just hearing it and he hears the Nickelback line. He's just like, oh my God, like, you know, this is the new song. Like, holy shit, this thing is amazing. The humor in the lyrics and that sort of thing.
I guess I thought it had the elements of Sloan that we were known for. And, you know, sometimes I was frustrated by then for being rewarded for the same song, whether it was, you know, Money City, Couldn't Everyone, Losing California, and all these Patrick songs. I felt like it was kind of, I thought that it could sneak into that, you know, it was my song, but it was like kind of playing the game that basically sort of aping what Patrick does, but, you know, using Patrick's voice too. And I thought that it had those elements and that it was exciting and all that kind of stuff. But it was never, you know, considered as a single. But I guess I thought that it was, I thought the same of Pen Pals too. I thought Pen Pals was a single, but I was wrong both times. What else? So it's got that that Sheryl Crow thing that, you know, I can't decide. I don't know. Did you think, Ken, did you say that you knew what the Sheryl Crow reference was?
I think there's a song called Soak Up the Sun, which would have been about contemporaneous.
Yeah.
Not that I'm an expert, but apparently I am.
I'm not either, but I liked those Sheryl Crow songs. But luckily we didn't make so much money that she's going to come after us. But we're fans.
Episode one of Crowcast.
We're fans, Sheryl.
There was also, I recall hearing an interview or reading an interview with you potentially at the time of release, and it might have been, you had short interview segments on the Vic website back when you had separate websites for the new album releases.
Okay.
About sort of what the lyrical content was about, and it was sort of at the time of the Gulf War, and it was, or the second Gulf War, and like, just go and take those resources, give me that.
Right. Yeah.
Is there any merit to that, or is that just sort of fit in afterwards?
No, I think that's probably true. That's also, I think that is sort of true. When I think about that kind of, I also kind of did that for that song called All I Am Is All You're Not. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a kind of like the smug Canadian kind of like, we would never do that. And of course we do. But yeah, I think it is kind of about that Gulf War, although, you know, not in a sort of mostly just fun way. Fun Gulf War.
Right.
But maybe that's why The Man couldn't have it be a single, because it's too political, man.
Right. Don't diss Nickelback in 2003.
That's right. And then our David and Goliath fight with Nickelback. We really...
Did that ever go anywhere? Did you guys like cross paths in a hotel somewhere and they're like...
I did ride an elevator with the Chad Kroeger one time, but I didn't interact with him. My feeling about Nickelback is that they are just like these hardworking people that don't deserve my eye roll or whatever. But and it's always shocking to me that so many people can love that kind of music. But then also, like, you know, I don't mean to compare them. They're not necessarily Trump people, but you know, Donald Trump was the president. So like, there are a lot of people that don't think like me. But
Smash Mouth was huge.
Exactly, yeah.
So maybe we move on to Live On, the next track. We can take this in a package with Backstab if you want. I feel as though they're kind of very, very similar and probably coming from about the same place compositionally.
I haven't even listened to Backstab in so long. We've played Live On in the past couple years. That's another, like, it's really just like one chord progression over and over again. And it's the same chord progression essentially as The Other Man, I think. Or Dr. Love by Kiss. it's another F sharp, underwhelmed, The Other Man, Live On. I liked it. You know, it's simple. I guess I feel like some of these, like Live On and Ready For You, like I like them, but they're quite simple. Like they kind of like, I like them as long as they're over in like 2 minutes. Like they just go on and on, maybe. Like, but Patrick builds on it. Like, it's got that sort of giving it up this time. Like, I think that's all nice. I think that he arranged it in a nice way. I think that it's, you know, kind of life affirming, kind of like Live On. Like, I don't have that kind of worldview where I'm thinking about that. I'm just a goofball, but his lyrical matter is heavier than mine. Pretty much by default. I'm just going to move through to Backstab in the next one. That's, I think, a goofier, like, you know, I think that we're playing with the idea of like being kind of rock cliches and of, a little bit that kind of thing. I found it was fun. Like, definitely it was the new, you know, it made me feel like I wasn't the only one hanging out there with a Pick It Up and Dial It. People are like, what the hell is this? You know, that, but I don't know, I get a kick out of it.
It is the song that brought us the turn of phrase "Mountain of Annoying."
I think Patrick's got some cool lyrics. Actually, like sometimes I feel like he's just like, how about like just go back and like add 8 more words into that song or something. Like, so repetitive. But like sometimes, like "Mountain of Annoying" to me is funny. But I really like in Backstab, give me that look, backstabbing with a positive. I think it's cool, but sure. You know, it's definitely in the realm of self-parody kind of thing. I don't know if Patrick would see it that way. He might get kind of pissed that I would say that, but I enjoy it.
I was just going to say, do you have an impression of him where he maybe goes for how a line sounds or how it's sung more so than, and then he kind of like puts lyrics to that shape?
Yes.
More so, because a lot of his stuff sort of feels like that. It's very singable, and then when you read it, obviously just sort of not basic, but I mean, like you said, it's his lyrics are traditionally something that you could just put on a bumper sticker, you know?
Yeah, I do think that Patrick has some fantastic lyrics, but I think that he also is like, this sounds good, that's what I'm saying. Whereas I would spend another 2 months wringing the catchiness out of it with like some smart joke. You know, for instance, you guys know that song G Turns to D, like I for like a couple months was singing John, You Made It On. Right. John, you made it on, you made it on. Just like that was my phonetic. And then I turned it to G Turns to D, and Jay was so mad. He was like, oh my God, that was so catchy. And what is this? G Turns to D, like gross. But in my mind, I was like, maybe, but like this makes way more sense. Like I'm so much prouder to read this than I would be if I, you know, sometimes I just settle, like keep on thinking, kind of means nothing. I wish the lyrics were better. Like I just feel like it kind of is just junky. And whatever, there are a couple songs like that of mine that are like, oh, this would have been, I really like what's going on here, but the lyrics are crappy. Anyway, I'm not criticizing Patrick. Is that clear? Okay, so where are we?
No, I was just going to say, hey, there's a great segue to talking about your song next.
Well, the rest of my life, I think is great and goes over really well. And I'm really happy that it got a chance on radio so that I can contribute to our bottom line and to our greatest hit set list. In a song that's a little bit different than some of the stuff that we had been rewarded for on radio prior. You know, the What Kind of Fool would think about it. Like, I guess I felt like that was a bit lazy. It was the same both times, but like often people leave little bridges the same both times or whatever. I don't know what part you even call that, a bridge or whatever. Or I guess it's a bridge that works.
Pre-chorus, whatever.
But anyway, I like that. My original demo for it was kind of a little bit more like keyboardy, like organ. And I had them like, ooh, like just, it was more.
Like a summer's my season kind of vibe or?
Yeah, not exactly. It was just more ricketier. Like the way we recorded it on Action Pack was just very, just way more muscular than I had. Not that it was envisioned, like, because in my mind, anything can be played any way. And I just feel like from a production point of view, it was playing ball. With the Roth Rock idea, and it's fine. I don't think it was. I don't have any regrets about that. But like, I have demos of it that are more poppy, I guess. But anyway, it ended up. I think because of the way we recorded, I think it got some legs on rock radio that it probably wouldn't have if I had listened to Jay tell me how to take the balls out of it. did I say that? I'm just joking. Okay, so False Alarm. False Alarm, we practiced a couple times. We played in the fall this year, and we tried to get Jay to sort of reinstate it for this Western leg, but I don't think he wants to do it. But we practiced a couple times. Maybe he will in a couple shows, but he didn't want to for these first couple. Right. But False Alarm, it's good. It's not, I mean, I find it just goes on too long and whatever. I think it's, but it's got a nice ending too, I guess. But
yeah. If you don't mind talking about the ending, I mean, I remember obviously at the time hearing it, you clearly hear you, Jay, and Patrick all singing in the end there. Like, so who was were you guys compiling that stack of vocals, or how would something like that come about? Who deciding who's singing what? And
I don't think, is it a three part? Like maybe it's a three part. Like it's mostly just me singing with. Been so long, been so long.
There's a lower part in there too, right?
So Jay's like, it's been so long, and I'm been so long, feels like it falls along. I'm below him, I guess. But then Patrick comes in that with that, like, whenever we're together. Like, that only he can do, basically. And whatever, I feel like that, is it Fun, Fun, Fun by the Beach Boys? Or it goes, someone described that as like the most euphoric sound in pop music history kind of thing. It's like, it's like so over the top, like at the very end. And like, I think, I don't disagree, but like, I think that little piece of Patrick at the end is so euphoric and cool on a Jay song.
Absolutely.
100%.
He doesn't often get to, often not invited to the party. Basically, since Gregory's been around, he's basically not been invited to the party because, you know, like Gregory handles all that kind of stuff. Gregory and I will do it. So anyway, it's, I know you guys know that I get romantic about the inner, when we inner play or whatever. So like, I love hearing that, like Patrick showing up at the end of a Jay song with such an awesome little part.
Yeah, such a great moment.
Sorry, one little also detail. When we were doing this tour in 2003, some of these songs like Rest of My Life were so high for me to sing and I was blowing out my voice that we did a whole, I think you're aware that we did the whole like half step down thing. And so some of these songs are confusing to me still because I had to learn whatever. We play them half step down. So, but then Jay's songs, Jay refused to do his songs a half step down and I didn't want to bring two basses. So I had to learn his in the next key up kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that goes for, we were even singing Good and Everyone and all these songs like a half step down. And, but Jay wouldn't do his. So I had to learn the lines you mend in C sharp and all this kind of stuff. So I'm kind of confused about a lot of how to play a lot of songs from this era. Cause I had to learn them both ways anyway. But we shouldn't have done that. We should have never have done the half step down stuff. It was just sounded like garbage. And definitely when Gregory kind of came into the picture, he was just like, there is no more half step down. Like those days, like knock it off. Sounds like garbage. Okay. So I'm done with the False Alarm.
I will add that False Alarm is one that pops up surprisingly often on fans kind of top 10 lists. I thought when we ran our poll, like just drop us your favorite Action Pack track, False Alarm, False Alarm, False Alarm, False Alarm. So it feels like it's a little bit more timeless in that sense, but perhaps than some of the
or is it because like real internet nerds are Jay fans? I mean, that's just the way it goes.
Fortnite, you know, Jay Ferguson.
From my vantage point, I think I've said before, like I like all aspects of what we do. But I think that there are some people, if you're a Jay fan, probably a lot of Action Packed is not your favorite. But Jay still, like Jay's is kind of like, False Alarm gets to have sort of like, it's Jangle, you know what I mean? Like on a record that's kind of like bar chords and Gibson's, you know what I mean? So he's got like this sort of like bright Jangle on top of False Alarm and Fade Away, whatever. It doesn't bother me that people aren't bother me, but just like does surprise me that there are definitely a contingent of people who are like, oh, that record False Alarm is the one that whatever is belongs more in the Sloan, seems more like Sloan than some of these other kind of like Harley Davidson rock stuff.
Right. I think the next one is actually a really interesting one. And we were riffing on this when we briefly recorded the last episode, essentially. Nothing lasts forever anymore.
Well, riff away.
Well, speaking of riff, Andrew introducing the 50 Cent Into Club guitar riff to this song, right?
Maybe that is that a story that I've told before? Maybe.
That's the inside scoop that the man himself gave me.
Well, we loved that song. That song was everywhere when we were recording this record. Yeah, I think there's a bit of that. Jay had that little like that. That's all Jay. I don't even think that it was attached to the song. I think he was just playing it. And I was like, put that over top of this thing. But Nothing Lasts Forever Anymore. This is another kind of like, it's all one chord progression the whole way through. And then it sort of modulates or whatever at the end. Mm. But the melody is the same. Nothing lasts forever anymore. But like the chords change. I don't know what that's called. Like it's whatever. I thought it was a cool trick or whatever. But this song for a long time was called Monica. Do you know this story?
No.
Based after Monica, as in Brandy and Monica. It's just like she had a song. I think her song was called I Want to Get Down, But Not on the First Night, kind of thing.
Not the first night, yeah.
I can make a move, but I want. It won't be right. I want to get down, but not on the first night. That's basically what that song is. Like it's just kind of like a rip on like a three chord song like that. And they're probably the same chords for all I know, but it's just like minor seventh chords, whatever. It's like 1-4-5 or whatever the whole time.
Right.
It was just like kind of an exercise in seeing if we could do it. Like I liked that kind of music. I wasn't trying to be as soulful as someone like Monica. I can't do that kind of singing, but that was my starting point. But then, but it's on this like hard rock record, So, it's kind of, on electric guitars, but there's actually in the guitar solo, there's kind of like a synthy bass. I think actually Andrew plays it and there's one major blues note in there. Like, it's like down 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 down. Like Andrew throws this weird bass note in. Like, listen to that; it's so funny. And this is the one where, like, yeah, Rothrock's like lying on his back, like, "Don't you know the time is right?" He's like, "Sing that 8 times." I'm like, "Okay," but anyway. Well, so yes,
was this a you had this prepared as a single essentially, right? I have a copy of this as a promotional or whatever CD.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anything became of that. I think the single artwork was made, and I don't think it went anywhere.
Okay,
I don't know what format that would have been. Even like, was that going to rock radio or like, I don't. It was a neither nor song. It was like, pop sensibilities with, flat footed drumming and like rock guitars. Yeah. So I have copies of that too. Hang on to those because it never went anywhere. I like the song though. I think it's fun. And it's, as I say, like the rest of my life. And these are like minor seventh songs in the sort of AC/DC record. So like, I feel like there's still like elements of Kraft and Sloan hidden in this record. Oh, I think the title is funny as hell to me. Nothing Lasts Forever Anymore. Like, I think it's, if nothing else, it's a funny title. It's probably about Leslie Feisty, who was easy on the ears and the eyes, a great singer, but whatever. I don't know lyrically if there's anything that interesting going on. My Rebecca, my wife now, if she ever goes, finds herself saying, "It's funny you say that," she pours it on. Like, "It's funny you say that." And she totally makes fun of me. Oh,
that's so good. No, it's so funny because we keep talking about, and I guess maybe just the first three songs really pour on, like, this is a rockin' album, just like Four on the Floor. But as you get through it, I mean, Rest of My Life and Nothing Lasts Forever, and we're going to come up to some of the other songs here too. I don't know. I just feel like there's an eclecticism here. I'm not sure if that's the word, but there's plenty going on here, and I think I'm noticing more and more that maybe this record got pigeonholed a little bit into the sort of like, oh, this is just a straight ahead rock record or whatever, but there's so much going on, and Nothing Lasts Forever Anymore is like a huge example of that. I love, it sounds so not hollow, but it sounds just like there's so much space in that song, and the sort of like, I loved like the tambourine that rings out and Andrew's fill at the end, and I don't know, so much cool shit.
Yeah. Well, I think the instrumentation alone is just kind of like, there's a sort of like unifying / unidimensional perhaps. Like if we did Nothing Lasts Forever Anymore today, it would probably be piano based and,
it would sound like So Far So Good or something.
Exactly. I don't know. Like probably, yeah, exactly. It probably just sounds exactly like something else I did because I only have about 3 tricks. But yeah, no, I mean, I think there's lots of variety from songwriting point of view on here, but there's not a lot of bass lines. There's only one kind of setup, similar instrumentation, and a lot of songs with one chord progression. That, this being one, False Alarm, as I say. Okay, I'm going to move on. Hollowhead, who wants to start the bidding? Hollowhead, best song on the record, anybody?
This is my favorite compilation of clips in the documentary, in the Keeping the Tour Alive documentary, when this song plays over Kev's footage of everybody goofing around. Whenever I hear this song, I always think of that, like you guys, like just doing, like you doing a spit take and, everybody rocking on stage and stuff.
I don't know what that is. I mean, I remember it. I think it's probably pretty funny. I should figure out how to put that together properly now. I think all of that stuff is just like, I don't think Kevin kept proper, MOV files of anything. I think everything is just, I would have to just rip it off a DVD or just go back to the original digital video and I'd have to re-edit the whole thing myself. It'd be a giant pain. But Hollowhead, I can't even think of how it goes. How does Hollowhead go?
Arms and elbows. Made to hold those.
I still can't even really remember the song. I feel like I gotta, this is kind of like bad podcasting, but I gotta think about
it. Well, I like the refrain that you keep like, talking. Love must grow. That's sort of like the end of the chorus. Or you will lose. Like, I like that that's sort of the message that's sort of refrains at the end of each chorus.
I remember it, but I'm just singing I was wrong, really, now. But I know it's like, hey, well, that's in your head.
Yeah, that's in your head. But next, Ready for You, which I, this one, oh no, it's not this one, it's Kid Anymore. This one and Not a Kid Anymore, to me, kind of like just sort of live in the same family in a way. Like, I just love the stomp of both of them, and they're both crowd pleasers, I feel, in the same way. And yeah, this is sort of like...
They're both like rock boxes. I think of it as like Money City in that it's like a six or whatever. What's it called? What's it, a Ken? Is it a 6-6-8 or 3-4 or whatever? Or it's like it takes six to get around. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, it's not a waltz time, not waltz time, but it's like 1, 2, 3.
Three, four, five, six.
I like Ready for You. I think it's funny, and or lyrically, I think it's more, the joke is like, I was like thinking of things that were, that you need two people in order to do, and then applying it to one or whatever. It's always like, or like, I'm begging my pardon, which is a stupid. And
I love breaking my own heart and rocking my.
Yeah. I'm breaking my own heart, rocking my world. Like, things that just so goofy to say, but like clearly just like taking from idioms that require two people and applying it to one. Mm-hmm. And, Ready for You.
Jealous,
we should have made $1 million off it, because there was TD Bank campaign called Ready for You, and I wanted to make $1 million off that, but whatever.
Oh, buddy.
Listening to the preview clips that you, that I guess Vic had posted on the Ash Impact website prior to the album's release, I was dead certain that this would be the next single following Nothing Lasts, following
Rest
of My Life.
I also thought it was built to be a single too. I thought it was whatever, pretty exciting and compact and whatever, even though I thought it kind of like owed something to Money City and it's like 6/4-ness.
Sure.
But wasn't to be. But the little part, Jealous of Myself is another one of those examples. Mm. But like that little part that turns into the, or like A, B, whatever that is, that little. Oh, and the solo, like the solo part, Taylor, my friend of the show, Taylor Locke, has joked that he's like, that's just like a bed track where a solo would go. How come no one did anything? I was like, well, it's kind of cool. And he's like, it's just, it's so annoying to me that there's this like this bed track with no lyrics on it in the middle of the song and no one's playing a solo. So I just thought that was kind of funny. He's kind of right, I guess.
Well, speaking of he's kind of right, the next song, I Was Wrong, is that the next song, Rob? You've got the,
it is,
okay,
yeah.
I'm going through this in my head. One that has been resurfaced for the current tour, I'm right.
That's right.
Tell us about your thoughts on this one. Does this break the mold of the past three Patrick tracks?
Well, it also owns, like, there's the I Was Wrong, You Were Right is kind of like Money City as well. Maybe purposefully, or maybe lazily, or maybe, I don't know, or maybe he's just, maybe it has nothing to do with Money City, but he's just, maybe he felt at the time that he's definitely not talking to me. He's talking to someone where he's admitting that he was wrong, but I don't see him ever saying that to me. I think of this as, and sort of like Hollow Head as being just kind of like muscular, you know, like Billy Idol type, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Billy Idol quarter note, rock songs that sort of live outside of, you know, there are other examples of it. I know that Patrick always kind of complained that Losing California was supposed to be a quarter note thing, like, but Andrew goes eights on it, and he's like basically been mad about it ever since. But these are like quarter note rock. They kind of approaching, you know, Harley rock a little bit, but I quite like I Was Wrong. I like it more than Hollow Head.
The intro is pretty punky. I mean, it could.
Oh, it's very, Billy sorry. Idol, it's very, feels... it's very Pistols. It's very Pistols. Right, the song is very Sex Pistols. Very Steve Jones, actually. Yeah. It's Scratch Billy Idol. This one is, it's very rocking, but like rocking in a sort of Sex Pistols way. That semitone sort of Eddie Cochran thing that Steve Jones says, mm-hmm. like. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, that's one of your opportunities to flourish the bass there. You've got a nice little...
A little bit, yeah. It's pretty, I could basically do it with one hand. no, I like it. I like singing it. And we got a really strong three part on it now. Gregory with his harmonies. Oh, it sounds awesome. We played it the last two nights. It sounds really great.
I like the little guitar piece at the end. I don't know who's playing that, but the little circular riff that's occurring over the outro.
Oh, we always joked in the studio this was like the Meow Mix commercial. Meow, 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 meow.
Okay, you ruined the song for me.
So, into the garbage with you.
If you play this in the Bowery, I'm going to fucking...
Are you going to the Bowery?
I am. I'll be there.
We may do the Meow Mix commercial at the Bowery. We'll see how it goes. I'm sorry to ruin it for you. You can cut out that. You can cut out that I'm ruining it. I love I Was Wrong. It's just a goof that we played the Meow Mix commercial.
Right.
So what songs are on this? I took a list from, I just took this from 2003 and I have this song as called You'll See Things. This next one, which is, and what is it called? It's called like,
Who Loves Life More.
Who Loves Life More. Yeah. It was for a long time. It was called You'll See Things. You'll see things in a different way. It just had different lyrics anyway.
Okay. Well, my N equals one on the next song is possibly a top three Chris Murphy lyrical concoction.
I think it's a fun, it's clearly kind of like, yeah, like there's a front half and a back half and they mirror each other and they're just slightly flipped with a couple good little jokes in there. I think it's probably the most sophisticated lyrical thing for me on this record. And musically, it's trickier than, we can't just like we could play Ready For You tomorrow, but we would take like 2 days to figure out how to play this thing.
The chorus is like a 7-4 tempo for like a hot minute in there. It's like, there's some timing like changes.
There's
in
some
the
extra
song.
Bars, but even in the, yeah. in the verses, I feel like it's like A, B, B, A or something. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like da na 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 da na 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 da na 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 da na 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 na.
Yeah,
it always screws me up. I don't understand it. I mean, I could get it, but it would take some concentration. Ready For You, for example, take zero concentration. Who Loves Life More would take me a little bit. And yeah, so lyrically, I'll just say yeah. So the whole setup is yeah, the person who stays up late and has fun, and then the next person who's got up early in the morning and got so much done. I just thought it was a cool construction and yeah, which person is enjoying life more, the person who's having fun or the person who gets stuff done. And I mean, I'd like to think that I'm both, but I'm probably have more fun getting stuff done than having fun because I'm a boring person. But that's part of the reason that we're still here.
One of the things I appreciate about the song is the honesty to admit that, you know, at the end, I fell asleep while I was still dressed, or I slacked off a little bit, or it's kind of like this, you know, ideological rock statement, but then concluded with this very humbling self-awareness.
Right. Well, I'd like to think that in the end, I'm self-deprecating in some way, but while secretly thinking that that Sloan is one of the greats and whatever. I just got a text from a guy. I should read it to you. I just got a text message through Instagram of a guy. I'll just read it to you just for fun. I won't say who he is. But he says, "Hi, Chris. Just a bit of feedback from a recent show. You come off as quite arrogant, talking down to your audience, and your attitude is distracting to someone who's trying to enjoy your music." And I did apologize. And I do mean to apologize, really. And I think that the guys in the band would be mad to know that someone feels that they're like, no kidding. Shut your face. Don't say anything.
I was going
to
say, was your answer Sorry, is this your first Sloan show or what?
Right. No, I said, sorry, bud. In. I'm just joking. Hope most people get it. Sorry I came off as such. Don't hold it against the rest of the guys. Huh? I'm not worried about it. Like, I think if you know me, you know that I'm just joking. But
they're leaving bad reviews. They're leaving bad reviews all over the internet. Don't worry about it.
Right. Well, anyway, I mean to say that I mean to come off as self-deprecating and all that kind of stuff. And my arrogance comes usually in the context of the band. And like, I really think the band is one of the greats. I don't mean to say it's because of me, but like, I feel like I get to ride in something that's great. I don't think it's because I'm great, but I hold on to this because I think it's great. And I think it has value and all that kind of stuff. And I'm mostly not saying you're welcome. I'm also saying thank you for letting me be here. Anyway,
as a super fan of the Chris Murphy In Between Song Banter, I was just going to say on behalf of everybody listening, don't change. And, you know, I love the self-deprecating comedy. And then you'll usually stonewall at the end, you know, with something like, you know, because we're the greatest. Or you'll say something like super, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Might come across as big-headed to somebody, but I love it. So never change, please.
Yeah, anyway. You know, you might not, if you're coming to see a music show, you might not know that the person talking thinks of themselves essentially as a comedian who doesn't have to profess to be a comedian because it would be too much pressure, you know. And when I start like running out of laughs, I just play a song. So, but I also, you know, I don't mean to be a Weird Al. I'm cool too. I got a leather jacket. So where are we? Reach Out. Reach Out's probably, that's probably Andrew's favorite song on the record.
Sure.
Every time he kind of like out of nowhere suggests a song, he either says, what's that one? An extra song from Never Hear the End of It. It's like Best Part of Your Life.
Best Part
of
Your Life.
Andrew loves that one. And he loves Reach Out. And Andrew goes nuts on Reach Out. Like, it's so fun to watch Andrew go completely crazy. It's so exciting. This is a one chord progression the whole time.
Yeah.
I think. I don't think it ever varies from that.
No.
There's majors and minors. Patrick wouldn't want a Beatles comparison, but you know, there's a major, minor Beatles stuff going on a little bit, but there is a sort of definitive action-packed quality to it. But I think it's awesome. I think it's, and I also think it's kind of earnest too. Like, you know, look at him, like live on and reach out.
Sure.
And
yeah.
Even I was wrong. Like this is kind of heavy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Patrick's, you know, singing the shit out of it. But Andrew's like the star of it. Like it's crazy live too. Like, and Andrew, sometimes Andrew, you know, in the big, doesn't do his big Dave Grohl intro into Underwhelmed or something. Although he did last night, or he's been doing it, but he'll go apeshit and Reach Out. I would be nervous to put Reach Out in a set because it will knock him out. Like he won't hold back. He'll go for it. And then I'm like, oh, he's going to be tired. But anyway.
No, 100% agree. Yeah, like this was, like Chris mentioned earlier, and we've talked on the show, like Andrew's presence on this record really is his performance, like playing the drums. And this song for me, for sure, is one, when I heard it, that was just like ultimately inspiring. It you get lost in how crazy the drums are.
Yeah, live, I can't remember if he did it like this on the recording, but like he plays it with a shaker.
And he's holding it with a stick?
At some point he just throws the shaker. And it's kind of exciting when he throws the shaker because he knows he's going to beat the shit out of the drums. Anyway, it's exciting. It's exciting even for me. Like I'm a fan within the band of like he's clearly awesome.
Yeah.
And by the way, he's just playing so well right now. And he's so just happy to be here. Like, I don't mean to analyze him, but just like, you know, he's been painting the past couple of years. I think he's just like in a good place, and he's just like happier to be here than he has been in years past, and he's playing the shit out of this stuff. It's whatever, again, from where I'm sitting, very happy about it.
And not to overanalyze, but I was thinking about what you said at the beginning of the show when you were kind of analyzing the audience response. Perhaps part of it could have been the pandemic and everybody, you know, having to be at home and that kind of thing. And, you know, and they say, you know, you can't fire an arrow without first pulling it back. And so maybe there's a bit of that going on with everybody, like the audience and the band. And, you know, so now we're getting this sort of recoil, which is very exciting.
Guys, we're at the end of our album. We're into Fade Away, which I can barely remember, but I think it's like one chord progression over and over again, right?
Yeah.
But I like it. It's cool. But it's cool chords. Like I think it would take me a while to figure out. It's a cool chord progression. And so, you know, it's kind of an outlier. It's like Not really. I mean, it's got, you know, Nothing Lasts Forever and The Rest of My Life to sort of like with minor chords and some craftiness that's a little less than kind of like, you know, boneheaded. But I guess it's a weird, I don't know much to say about Fade Away, except for I think it's cool chord progression and cool way to end the album. But I don't remember the words or anything. Do you guys have any good fodder?
I was going to say, I like the literalness of fading away at the end of the album, it being the last song. And for me, musically, like, I don't know if this is a matter of Jay kind of had these songs in one, they were maybe written in the same vein or whatever, but like the Pretty Together Jay stuff, like Dreaming of You and Who You're Talking To and Fade Away to me kind of have like a sort of, again, like I was saying earlier with a couple of your tracks, they kind of feel like, you know, the same sweater or something. Like they sort of feel like they live together and are kind of maybe pulled from the same pool. I don't know if there's any insight in that regard, but anyway, this song definitely to me sort of feels very much in common with what he was doing. And it again reminds me like what you were saying earlier, like, you know, there are pieces of this album that could have existed certainly on different projects. And for me, the Jay stuff is sort of it stands out because it's just so him, and his songs really could, in a way, especially on this record, they could fit on Pretty Together. They could fit on Never Hear the End of It, in a way. You know, they are maybe sort of the musical bridge more than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we had to do a little bit of convincing of Rothrock, but I feel like Rothrock was conceiving of the thing with basically without Jay songs, and we're just like, we have to have Jay songs. Like, maybe they're a little bit outside what you're picturing, but like, I think it's... We owe it to Jay and fans and the band to have some semblance of what we are. I don't think it's that Rothrock didn't like the songs. I think that he was just trying to streamline it. But we're like, well, okay, we'll try to. But, you know, and Jay, you know, played ball from a production point of view. Like, there's no piano and all that kind of stuff. Like, what's the word? Oh, brief. He's following the brief or whatever. It's like, here's the instrumentation and you know, loud guitars and stuff like that.
Well, I will say this, the sequencing and song selection on the album did ultimately lead to the greatest Sloan bonus track potentially in the catalog, Step On It Gene. So it allowed Step On It Gene to be a separate release on a separate 7-inch, and I'm all there for that.
I think that it's not called Step On It Gene, it's called Who Loves Life More. No, it's called, sorry, I blew my own joke. There's another one that I wrote, Will You Ever Love Me Again? Anyway, no, Step On a Gene is awesome. Like, I think it's awesome, and it's probably would have been better on here than Backstabbing or something like that. But no, Step On a Gene is cool, and it's recorded it's kind of more exciting sounding than this stuff. This stuff sounds proper and slick, but there's like, it's not, whatever. It doesn't sound that exciting to me. It just sounds kind of normal or something. Whereas Step On a Gene was recorded by Ian McGettigan and is, I forget if it was recorded on analog, but it's more exciting and dirtier and stuff. It's fun.
I recall Jay having talked about wanting to make it sound like some of the later Beatles direct to console recordings where they weren't really going through an amp, but they were just using the gain on the console to make that sound. So
maybe that's what we did. I think I kind of feel like it was probably still through our Logic, using Logic, but yeah, I think it was done at our rehearsal space. So, but it was done by Ian McGettigan and the B-side was the Pony Deluxe song called Dirty Nails.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. And then the other song associated with this is, as I say, it's called Will You Ever Love Me Again, which I liked okay, but whatever. It's not a shame the way, you know, Summer's My Season would have been better than All By Ourselves or whatever, anyway, it's just another song associated with this time. Now, the other thing I should say about this time or whatever is that we were, whereas Pretty Together came out through the RCA system in the United States, and then this got made with Canadian money and was finished because it wasn't funded by RCA, that got shut down by Clive Davis, all that kind of detail. You went into it a bit in the last episode. So we were without a label, and then we just ended up on this label called Koch, C-O. K-O-C-H. And it was not really cool or a great place to be. It was just like, we basically had no choice and we didn't know where to go. And by the time we got to Never Hear the End of It, we were hooked up with Yep Rock, with whom we are still putting out records in the States. So we were kind of flailing, and I think, you know, Koch, have I joked before that, like, our label mate was William Hung. You remember that guy? Like, like that. That's who was on American, Koch.
The American Idol.
The American Idol.
Parody act.
A-Sides was on Koch, by the way.
It was, yeah. So we were kind of like just sort of stuck there for a while. And then that got bought by like E1 or something. I don't know. It doesn't matter. But we were happy to be on Yep Rock. So this record kind of hung out there. I don't know how many people found out about it. The other thing that we did do at this time was we opened for that band Jet. We did a whole little tour in the States opening for Jet. So we did take on some new fans, and we got, I mean, I don't know if that counts as a new generation of fans, but like they definitely had some people who came on to us kind of thinking we were a little bit more hard rock than we were. And then, and then we put out Never Hear the End of It, and they're like, what's this? There are some people out there that for whom Action Packed is their favorite. You know what I mean? The people who are like, if you're a fan of the kind of that aspect of the Venn diagram that we have, or like, you're like, if Patrick is your favorite and you like rock music, and you know, I definitely have asked, you know, I like Kiss was my favorite group and a kid and all that kind of stuff. Like, from my vantage point, like, I don't think Andrew ever liked this record, and I was pissed at him at one point because he basically saying in the press that he thought, he was like, yeah, it wasn't that good. I'm like, dude, but I can understand how, you know, he doesn't probably feel that much ownership over it, and not much of his sensibility, except for his awesome drumming, as we said, is his fingerprint is not on it. So I don't mean to say that I prefer this to what Andrew does, but I think it's an interesting aspect of what we've done. And
yes,
I think it was, given that we've made as many records as we've had, and we've attempted to make different kinds of records, I think that this was a success to have attempted. And again, the only thing that ever bothered me about it was the amount of time that it was our most recent statement. It just seemed to go on and on.
Sure. And I mean, without Action Packed, there would be no Never Hear the End of It, which is arguably, and for many fans, your greatest statement. So, you know, it fits into the Sloan jigsaw puzzle. It's the last kind of piece binding the left side and the right side.
Well, for you guys, I would, as experts in Sloan, I'm an expert too. So now given what we've done now, what are we supposed to do? What should we do next? You tell me. We do another double record, or are we all like, how can we top Never Hear the End of It? We were able to do a different double record because we had a different shtick on the Commonwealth record. But now what do we do? Like, I kind of like doing double records because, you know, the same as I said in the set list, I only have like room for one extra song. As you know, on Never Hear the End of It, I was able to do so many songs and so many, and Never Hear the End, not just me, but like, there's so many weird songs on that. I just think it allows for, when you only have three chances, like, you're not going to put, you know, people think they know me. Maybe you shouldn't have even, people think they know me if you had 30 chances, but you know, maybe that's a bad example because that song is kind of garbagey.
Yeah. Is it? No.
Except for the Andrew's bit. My duet with Andrew.
You get to, on People Think You Know Me, you get to at least drop a curse word, which I think will appeal to our younger fans. But
that's right.
Are there monetary differences in the year 2023 in releasing a double album versus releasing a single? Like, is it, obviously when you're pressing vinyl, that's a consideration, but in terms of production, and is that a huge deal?
I mean, when we do, we kind of have two different ways that we do it. When we do a record, the most recent record came out on Yep Rock in the States, and it came out on Universal in Canada. And our band is not responsible for coming up with the manufacturing money. That's handled through Universal and Yep Rock, and in whatever configuration they do it. They each make vinyl. They each make CDs, I think. Sometimes it's been such that we make all the vinyl in Canada and Yep Rock buys some office, or, you know, sometimes there are different ways to do it. But when we make our own record, or we make the reissues, or like the punk record or the B-sides, like, we have to pay for all the manufacturing. So there is like a cash flow issue. And even like once we, so like now Twice Removed, One Chord to Another, and Navy Blues are technically in print, you know, you can get those records now, but we have to come up with the cash flow. It's like, we need to make 500 more. It's like, okay, we need to, So as you know, like not all of our records are in print. And but I don't think we make that much money from the record sales themselves when we do it through Universal. Like they give us some money to do it. We may make their money back. Like, there's not a lot of money changing hands, really. We make all our money playing shows. You know, maybe Yep Rock or Universal might balk at the idea of making a double record because the manufacturing costs would be prohibitive or something.
Right.
But I don't know. I don't think so. I think the question is more, in the modern world, do people have the brain space for that much music when they're looking at their phones all day long? You know, it's one question for a new band, but it's another question for us. People already have 13 of our records. Like, they could probably digest a double record. You know, we haven't had one. If we put out a double record next and we do a reissue, like, it will have been, how long will it have been since our last double record? It'd be at least 10 years.
10 years, yeah.
Anyway,
my vote is for double record next. Do it. New double record.
Maybe this is all doesn't make sense on this episode, and that's fine. But had a fun time talking about Action Packed. I think it was a cool thing to have made, and I'm proud of it. And I think that there's more variation, as you suggested, Rob, than maybe is immediately understood. You know, the instrumentation kind of similar and all that kind of stuff. But I think it's cool. I think there's lots of, I think all of the songs are pretty cool. Back Seven's probably the most maligned, but I think that even it is kind of funny. And to me, it gets its own joke. Like, I don't think it's like, can you believe, like, it's like, I was there. I get jokes. It's funny.
For sure. Thank you for coming on and chatting us through each of those songs. And we're looking forward to potentially seeing one or two of them being performed live during the anniversary year.
Hey, if you're flying transatlantic, you can hear whatever you want. What do you want to hear? You just text me.
Let me think about that one.
Amazing. Yeah. Thanks
guys. I really appreciate, I love your show, and I'm really happy that it exists. And even though I missed Cocaine Bear tonight, I think it's worth it. I'll see it again another time. I think everyone bailed. Yeah.
Awesome, buddy. Well, thank you. And it's not the anniversary yet, but, you know, happy 20th anniversary to Action Packed. And my thesis for these episodes has been, and for most records that we speak about on the show, is my intention is to have people go back and give it a re-listen if they haven't heard it in a while. So, and hopefully we'll have some more content coming out over the course of the end of the year, celebrating the 20th anniversary, and some more episodes, perhaps other band members. We'll see, perhaps other people who are involved in the project, and very excited for that.
Right on. Thanks, you guys.